podcast from the Royal Air Force Museum. For further information, please go to www.rafmuseum.org/podcasts.
Welcome to part one of the Royal Air Force Museum special podcast on the RAF's role in the Normandy campaign. This one covers D-Day. What you are about to hear is a dramatisation based on memoirs and letters held in the museum's archive. The accounts you are about to hear are reproduced verbatim from such sources.
This is London calling. You join us today at an RAF station in the north of London where a press conference is being held. With us are some of the brave men and women of the Royal and Women's Auxiliary Air Forces who have been involved in the recent Allied landings in France. They will be able to tell us about their contribution to the build-up to D-Day and the opening of the historic events currently unfolding across the English Channel. With us, first of all, is leading aircraftsman Harry Clift, who is an armourer with one of our Typhoon squadrons. Can you tell us about the differences you noticed in the build-up to the invasion?
Towards the end of May, we were told that meals would be available to us at any time of night and day. If we were working into the night and after the work was completed, we were hungry, then a meal would be available in the dining tent. Items of food were provided that we'd not seen since before the war. The standard of meals was greatly improved and butter, cheese and bread were placed on the dining tables. This was to build us up in readiness for the months that would have to exist on compo rations.
Miss Ehack, Daily Scoop, what preparation did you do the day and night before?
On the 5th June, the squadron was very busy attacking radar stations and strong points in the invasion area. At night in the dark, we were issued with buckets of black and white paint and brushes. By the light of headband torches, we painted black and white identification bands on the underside of all the aircraft, so they would be recognised as friendly when operating over the beachhead the following morning.
Now, Pilot Officer Leslie Glover, you actually flew over the beaches, did you not? What was your role and what was it like?
In preparation for the D-Day landings, we re-equipped with Spitfires and were specially trained for several months to form part of a small combined RAF and Fleet Air Arm wing responsible for the direction of the naval bombardment on Normandy. The scene from 10,000 feet over the beachhead at first light on the 6th of June 1944, when the Allied fleet opened up as one, is something I shall not easily forget. We stayed with the naval guns until the battle moved further inland and beyond their 20-mile range, and absorbed an object lesson in the accuracy and effectiveness of this mighty weapon of war, but under our control.
We have with us another pilot too, Lieutenant Hubert Neelands, who is actually an American, serving on attachment with one of our bomber squadrons. Lieutenant Neelands, you were involved in an operation to fool the Germans by flying bombers low over the water so they would look like an invasion fleet on their radar screens. How did that work? It must have been demanding.
Well, ma'am, 8 crews would fly for 4 hours. 8 more would take their place for another 4 hours. The pilots would have to do some precision flying. Each plane would fly 35 seconds on course, make a control turn and fly a reverse course for 32 seconds. Then a slow turn back on the first course, while throwing out some more window. I would be starting the original course slightly ahead of where the previous lot dropped into the water. Thus, there would be no interruption of blips on German radar. I had to fly 200 miles an hour in a series of circles that carried me forward at only 8 miles per hour.
And you had to fly with this precision for 4 hours?
Well, there were 12 aircrew on board my Lancaster, R for Roger. Pilot Officer Castanola's crew were coming along to share the flying and windowing duties. Harry, my navigator, guided us in a position. I began my hour of very intense flying duty. On course, turning, leveling out, on course, turning, minute after minute. All the time, Harry's voice was droning in my earphones. Tighten the turn, you're 2 seconds slow. You're 3 feet too low. On course, begin turn now. Ease up, you're 3 seconds too fast. This went on for an hour. I had to keep within 4 seconds elapsed time and within 5 feet of altitude at all times. It was a relief to have Kaz Castanola slip into my seat. His navigator took over for Harry. 3 others of his crew relieved those of mine who had been dropping window bundles at 4 second intervals for an hour. The second wave took over from us.
All of this activity meant that thousands of aeroplanes were in the air that night. A complicated system of control was needed to prevent accidents and make sure everyone was in the right place at the right time. Now, Sergeant Betty Morrell, you were in an operations room that night. How did you find the build-up for the invasion affected you?
Well, towards the end of May, all leave was cancelled and everyone was confined to camp. Absolutely no one was allowed out of the gates, except for the ration lorries and an emergency hospital case, and they had to be escorted by security police. All mail was censored and no one could make outside phone calls. The reasons for all this were kept firmly under wraps, but it wasn't difficult to guess what was going to happen. Airborne troops were camped on the far side of the airfield and gliders were stacked in rows. Clearly, something extraordinary was being planned. There was to be a big exercise on the night of June the 4th, but due to bad weather, it was postponed for 24 hours. Well, we'd had big exercises and postponements before, but this time it all seemed very different.
It must have been very tense.
The whole station was holding its breath. On June the 5th, I was on the afternoon shift, which is 2 till 10pm. The whole place was buzzing with activity, phone messages, signals, and a lot of coming and going from the squadrons and army units. At last, the orders came through from command, and we were told what was going on. Our squadron and others in 38 and 46 groups were going to drop gliders and paratroops into German-occupied France, Normandy. This was it, the start of the long-awaited invasion of Europe. Tonight's exercise was actually the beginning of Operation Overlord. A massive seaborne fleet was already heading towards the French beaches. June the 6th, 1944, was to be D-Day.
Were you busy that night?
Not a soul went off duty that night. The night shift arrived, but we were told to stay on duty. Not that I wanted to go. There was far too much going on. Our planes took off shortly after 2300 hours. The ops room began to fill up. First Group Captain Abrahams, the station CO, then a lot of other officers from the squadron offices, in fact anyone who was allowed to be there and not flying, came in and out during that night. The air began to fill with cigarette smoke. It was going to be a long night, and the normal rations of food and drink soon ran out, with all those extra bodies wanting sustenance. Around midnight, the CO left and reappeared a short time later bearing a large tray laden with new supplies. He said he'd burgled the officer's mess pantry and would have to own up in the morning. After a long wait, the signals came to say that drop had been successful and the planes were returning to base. We ate a lot of bits and pieces, drank lots of tea and coffee, and smoked a lot of cigarettes, and waited for the planes to return. They all returned safely that night, and there was a long session of debriefing. And when the morning shift arrived, we were allowed to join the crews for a huge aircraft breakfast. Everybody hung about until the BBC told the world of the Allied landings, and then we finally collapsed into bed, excited and exhausted.
We are all... flying that night. Can you describe to us what happened?
Operation Tonga got underway as Wing Commander Booth took off at 20. Said that he had a jeep with a trailer full of ammunition, a 6-pounder gun, and 6 men. The cloud base was low and we flew at 1,000 feet. We saw no one else at all the way there and back. As the visibility was so poor, we descended about 15 minutes from our ETA to 800 feet and, at the very moment the nav cries time, we could just discern the vague outline of the coast. Staff Sergeant Saunders called out, "Going now," and immediately pulled off. We turned away and landed back at base at 0240 hours, after a flight of 3 hours and 50 minutes. All the other 6 returned, and all reported no enemy aircraft at all, and only very light flak. Not one aircraft received any damage at all. We learned, a day or two later, that the bridge had been captured with great success.
Were you involved at all in the resupply and reinforcement flights during the day?
On the morning of the 6th, we briefed for Operation Mallard. This was to be part of the very big airborne landing throughout the afternoon onto what we named DZN. 15 of us were to tow 15 horses loaded with personnel from the Royal Ulster Rifles. We were to drop late evening and, as we arrived overhead, we saw the landing ground absolutely. There and back, we had a continuous cover of fighter aircraft overhead. There was again very little light flak, and that only on the very coastline itself. Again, no damage of any nature to the aircraft.
Thank you very much, but I'm afraid that is all we have time for. In our next broadcast, we will be talking to some of the personnel involved in the operations to establish the beachhead.
Welcome to part two of the Royal Air Force Museum special podcast on the RAF's role in the Normandy campaign. This one covers the push inland from the beaches. What you are about to hear is a dramatisation based on memoirs and letters held in the museum's archive. Where the interviewees are introduced by name, the accounts you hear are reproduced verbatim from such sources. Where the interviewees are kept anonymous, they are composite facsimiles based on careful research by museum staff.
This is London Calling. You join us today at an RAF station in the north of London where a press conference is being held. With us are some of the brave men and women of the Royal and Women's Auxiliary Air Forces who have been involved with the push inland from the invasion beaches in France. They will be able to tell us about their contribution to the historic events currently unfolding across the English Channel. Our ground attack aircraft have been heavily involved in helping the army, attacking ground targets to support their advance. Some of the squadrons involved are now operating from advanced landing grounds in France, and we have here some of the ground crews working in these dangerous zones. Firstly, leading aircraftsman Len Bellamy, who was sent across as a member of the advance party of a Typhoon squadron. You arrived in France in mid-June, and then what happened?
Our Typhoons arrived the next day and we were fully operational.
And what was it like in France?
Life was about the same as it had been in England, daily inspections and rearms. The only difference was that every time our planes took off, the Germans would start shelling us. We had to take cover until the shelling stopped, then carry on with our duties. Our biggest enemy was the sand. As our planes took off, they created a major sandstorm. The breechways of our guns were clogged up. After every flight, we had to remove the guns, strip them down, clean all the sand off and reassemble, and then replace them in the aircraft. We were working all day and part of the night on our guns.
And we are joined again by leading aircraftman Harry Clift. What was your principal feeling at being on these forward bases?
Owing to the flatness of the land and the short distances to the targets, we could watch our Typhoons take off from the landing strip, form up over the sea, fly and land to the target, dive on the target, release their rockets, pull out from the dive and circle the strip ready to land. It gave us a feeling that we were personally involved in the attack.
We also have with us Flying Officer Harry Hardy, one of the pilots operating these close support Typhoons. Can you tell us about your first operation flying from a base in France?
I flew my first op as wingman to Blue Section Leader. He impressed on me how I was to stick to him like glue and not take any chances till I learned the system. The battle area was covered in smoke and dust. I could not determine the target in the poor visibility. I stuck to his wing as we dove straight down onto the target. I had one eye on the battle below, one eye on him, and the other eye on his bombs. When he released his bombs, I released mine. So much for my exciting first op, I never did see the target.
Was that a typical operation? What are they usually like?
Each op consisted of dive bombing attacks and about seven strafing runs. A strafing run started by lining up on your target at about half a mile out, getting it squarely on your gun sight, and as you approached at about 400 miles an hour, opening fire at 400 yards. Fire about 15 rounds from each cannon, a 1 second burst, and pull up just missing the top of the target. All the time, every German soldier within range is shooting at you. Speed is your only ally on a strafing run. 20 rounds from the end, we had 5 tracer bullets. We stopped strafing ground targets when we saw our tracers. We carried 20 rounds home in case enemy fighters jumped us on the way.
Now, not all the RAF's operations are over the front lines. A constant stream of transport aircraft takes supplies and reinforcements into France and also bring wounded personnel out. We are lucky to be joined by one of the WAF nurses who fly in these aircraft, tending the wounded men. Now, it's unusual for women to act as aircrew, is it not?
There are only a few of us ladies that are associated with aircrew. A call was put out to Princess Mary's RAF Nursing Service and WAF Nursing Orderlies for air ambulance duties, and so I volunteered.
And what do you do?
My role requires for the comforting and assisting of the patients who are being brought back from Normandy and other areas nearby. They have terrible injuries and it is much quicker to bring them back by air than by sea. I am responsible for making the patients as comfortable as possible, comforting them and giving them tea. If we are transporting unconscious patients with head injuries, we have to move them every 20 minutes. I may have to administer more morphine occasionally, although we do have a PM sister on board who will usually undertake such duties.
How often do you go over to France?
There are usually 3 flights a day. The flights take place at all times of the day, from early morning to night. We take out supplies and so therefore are not allowed to have a Red Cross painted on the side of the plane. It makes our journeys much more difficult. I have a parachute which I can wear on the way out, but not on the way back. My duty is to look after the patients, and they do not have parachutes, and so neither will I.
And of course, once they are in England, they still need to be taken to the hospitals. Leading aircraftswoman Kathleen Chamant, you are an ambulance driver for the Casualty Air Evacuation Centre. How do you deal with the casualties once they had landed?
We were given 1,500 weight standard ambulances to drive, and as the Dakotas arrived with their casualties, we lined up close to the aircraft while parties of RAF stretcher bearers stood by ready to unload the sick and wounded into our own ambulances, 4 stretchers to each vehicle. Then we were off on the slow, careful drive back to temporary medical huts at the CAEC. There, doctors, nursing sisters and medical orderlies of the RAF were in attendance.
And what sort of care do they receive there?
The men were washed, shaved and fed, and had dressings on their wounds changed. They received whatever care was urgently needed before more ambulances were required to drive more serious cases away to more permanent RAF and Army hospitals some miles away.
Thank you all very much, but I'm afraid that is all the time we have today. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the Royal Air Force Museum.